90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. You are listening to Next Step Forward. I'm your host, Jasmine Jones. I am here with a special guest, D. Rashad Gilmore. He's the president and the CEO of Blackout KC. He's also the host of Unbossed and Unbothered, which comes on Saturdays at 5 p.m. right here on KKFI. Sir, welcome.
I am so happy to be here on your debut show as an inaugural guest, and I promise I will be on my best behavior.
You can be a little bad.
Good, because it kind of bleeds out of me naturally, so I'm glad we have an understanding. But really, it's an honor to be here, and kudos to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to join me here. So we're going to jump right into it.
Okay.
I've got a lot of questions, not a lot of time. So Blackout KC, Blackout KC's mission is to bring about a community where Black queer people in the greater KC metro are connected and supported, have access to safe places and sufficient resources to help them thrive. So tell me, how and when did Blackout KC start? And before you answer, I notice that Blackout is spelled with a Q.
Yes.
I'm assuming that's on purpose. Q is for queer?
That's correct. We focus on the Black LGBT community, and so the Q is for queer.
Okay.
And because we're Black and we just do things differently. We don't just leave words as they are. We create new words and new spellings of words. So it fit for that reason too.
Okay. So how did Blackout start? How did the organization begin?
Well, really, like so many things, I mean, our origin story is really layered.
Mm-hmm.
And so while the actual nonprofit entity came into being in April of 2017, the idea for Blackout preceded it by at least 5 years, where we were working, myself and a former partner, my former life partner, looking at how could we make a difference and have an impact on HIV rates in our community. We had lost a couple of dear friends, and we had other friends who were living with the virus.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to do something. It was just this idea that was floating around, Blackout. And we were working with an artist at the time who had that name, that word in his name. We thought, this would be a good outreach arm for you, but that went separate directions, and we decided a few years later that it's time to make Blackout a reality.
Okay, so you had this idea. What were some of the steps that you took? Like, okay, I got this idea, so how do I get this ball rolling?
Well, I'll be honest, and I'm really glad that you're talking about, you know, this subject in a way that hopefully others can take notes and find it instructive,
right,
and learn how to go about the process themselves. But there are several steps in the process. And I think for us, we did something a little bit differently. Well, actually quite a bit different than what most people do.
Mm-hmm.
Normally people say, oh, I have an idea. I want to start a nonprofit. I'm going to go out and get my name out there or do programs or do some event. And sometimes that's the right thing to do. For us, we started from a different perspective. We started by doing a health needs assessment with the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Medicine,
mm-hmm,
and their community health research group, which is led by Dr. Jeanette Berkeley Patton. Our goal was to get the data, find out what the community felt were the critical issues that needed to be addressed, rather than us, even as community members ourselves,
mm-hmm,
telling the rest of the community what they needed to do. So in any event, we did that health needs assessment, and that became a key driver for us. I will tell you, there are people and organizations in this city within walking distance of this station who were none too pleased that we did the study, but we didn't do what academics normally do, which, mm-hmm, is to just immediately publish findings. And we didn't do that because we wanted to make sure that we were in the driver's seat. And if other people had that data, they would certainly use it to get money on our behalf.
But not actually use
it. But it wouldn't be us.
Gotcha.
Exactly. So, yeah.
So do you feel like going a different route actually helped the success or the growing success of Blackout then?
I think in the case of Blackout, unquestionably, I mean, we were in a position where we were in the driver's seat because we had the data. And I say to people all the time, data drives dollars.
Yes.
And because we had the data, we were the experts in our own lives, not somebody else who was outside of our community, whether that be somebody who was heterosexual or somebody who was not Black. It put us in a position to be able to lead for ourselves.
Gotcha. So in prepping for the show, I noticed that you said that Blackout is food for us, by us.
Yes, God, yes.
What was the reason to make sure that this organization is for us, by us? Like, was there something that triggered it? Did you feel like in other LGBTQ communities that you are spaces that you felt welcome but not really welcome? Is that kind of what sparked
Absolutely. I mean, you kind of, you know, hit the nail on the head. Part of it is that we understand what we need, and mm-hmm. we don't need anybody to tell us how we should live our lives or solve the problems that we confront. We do need help. Mm-hmm. We need support, but we don't need anybody telling us what to do. Part of what happened was we looked at it and said, okay, listen, there are all these organizations in this city that get millions, millions of dollars each and every year, ostensibly for us. But they hold the biggest part of the money and then the millions, and they give us, you know, come get a, you know, HIV test and a $15 gift card. Well, wait a minute. We have thoughts and ideas about how we can address needs in our community. Where are those resources? Mm. So it positioned us in a very good way. And yes, it is because who better than us?
Right.
Who better than us?
Right. Did you find, and I don't know if you've been involved in other LGBTQ organizations, but did you find that your voice was not as, I guess, accepted as far as the Black community? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was listened to, but wasn't really taken in and actually acted upon.
I think that's a great question. You know, one of the things that I often say, and I live my life in this way, and I certainly lead Blackout in this way, that I am not interested in being the ornamentation or accessory to anybody else's vision. Mm-hmm. And so just because you invite us to a meeting or, you know, throw a few little crumbs our way that we're supposed to be so grateful for, I just wasn't interested in doing any of that. And I will tell you, there were dollars that came our way that we passed on. Mm. And my philosophy was, I am not interested in trying to put pretty yellow flowers in the front yard. My goal is to make sure there's food on the table, we have a solid foundation, a roof that doesn't leak, there's love in the house. You know, those are the things that were most important to me, not some, and often it was white-led organizations whose agenda was not to support the work, mm-hmm. but to co-opt it.
Oh.
And you can't co-opt me.
Right.
It's not possible.
So, I want to talk a little bit about discrimination.
Ooh, okay.
Because also in my research, I did find that there is discrimination within the LGBTQ community. Can you kind of expound on that a little bit?
Sure. You know, I tell these sort of stories when I am doing trainings on race relations and that sort of thing. And so I have a sort of one of my standard presentations that I do is called Racism Under the Rainbow. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of times people, pardon me, assume that, well, because there's a shared struggle in one area, that the same sort of care or concern applies to other areas, and it does not. You know, for a very long time in this country, we were focused on marriage rights. Mm-hmm. And that was really, you saw mainly, not exclusively by any means, but mainly white queer couples who were feeling denied, and indeed were denied, a privilege that heterosexual couples were allowed. But their focus was on trying to achieve what their straight counterparts, their heterosexual counterparts got. We were fighting just to be included in spaces that ostensibly were for us, but didn't feel very warm or welcoming, as you said. Mm. And so the same, is this thing on? The same racism that exists outside of the LGBT community absolutely exists inside of it and under the rainbow. And there are many numerous examples in our own city. Shall I name names? I won't. Okay.
I'm about to say, we won't spill the details.
Well, if you like, I can tell you a quick little story.
Okay.
That sort of highlights the problem.
Okay.
I had been consulting, working in Detroit, Michigan for a period of time, myself and a former partner, and one of my clients was the Ruth Ellis Center, which is an LGBT drop-in center in Highland Park. It's a really poorer part of Detroit, mm-hmm. Separate city, but you could drive straight down Woodward Avenue and you would drive through Highland Park and be back in Detroit in a straight line. But when I got back here, I thought, man, I really would love to see something like that here in Kansas City. And so I got an invitation on Facebook to an event for an opening of a space. I won't call names, but it's not very far from where we're sitting right now. Uh-oh. And so my partner and I go in. And by the way, you know, we move pretty fluidly through communities, you know, white, black, wealthier, less wealthy, that sort of thing. But when we got into the space, I mean, we weren't even 10 feet inside the door before you could just feel, and I know, as black folk, we mm-hmm. know what that's like. You can just mm-hmm. feel like the looks you're getting are like, why are you here?
Right. What are you? Right. You don't belong here.
You don't, right. And
go
right,
somewhere
who sent
else.
You?
Yeah.
And so we immediately decided, oh no, we have other and better things to do. So we were going to make a beeline for the back door because it was open. They were doing a photo shoot out there. Well, as it happens, we were walking out And as I am wont to do, I saw some cake and I needed to have a piece of that cake before I left. And so we paused to get some cake, and there were two women, one older, one younger. Mm-hmm. The women both looked at us and then looked away back to each other and kind of made this face like, you know, what's going on with them? The older woman then came over and said, "Hi, have you been taken around?" I said, "We have not. We were just leaving." She said, "May I please take you around?" Okay, fine. So we go on this tour with her, and we get back to where we started, and she said, "I don't mean this to come across offensively, but I do just want to say that we really want to have more young black people like yourself involved, and if you can help with that, that would be great." And so I took that opening to say, well, if any of them had the experience that we had coming in this door, not only will they not come back, but they'll tell their friends, and their friends will never come either. Mm. She said, "Oh my God, you're right. I'm glad you gave me that feedback. Let me get the executive director. She needs to hear from you." So after making us wait for quite some time, the executive director comes back. I relay this experience, to which she replies, and I kid you not, end quote, "You know, I think we just need to have a black night." And it reminded me of stories that my mom told growing up in Kansas City when they had that amusement park out south of Funland, I think it was called, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they would have one day a year, like on Hairspray, Negro Day.
Wow.
And that was the answer that she had. And so, again, this was just a few years ago. It's a long story, but it highlights the point that people come to life and to situations with all of their lived experiences. And so you don't get to leave out any parts of your identity. It will bleed through.
So it's more like a band-aid than an actual solution then. Like, well, we need more black people. We'll just have a black night. And then that fixes it.
Yeah, and it's so incredibly offensive. You know, I look at it this way. I don't like to give cough drops for lung cancer.
Oh, that's
because you can quiet
good.
The cough.
Yeah.
But eventually you're going to need some more yes. serious treatment of some kind or, yes. or a transplant.
So I would imagine that experiencing discrimination, racism as a black person, but then to also combine that as being part of the LGBTQ community, that causes a lot of emotional and mental stress issues. What kind of services or programs does Blackout have to kind of cope and combat those kind of things?
Well, but before I answer that question directly, I will say that part of the problem that many of us face is that we're too black to be gay and too gay to be black.
So what does that mean, though?
Well, I think in broader LGBT circles, the black presence is not welcome unless it's being appropriated or fetishized.
Mm. We'll talk about that in a moment.
But we certainly should. And then in black circles, it's like, you're black, but we don't really do that gay stuff. Like, you're non-binary, or you're trans, or you're pansexual. Like, what do these things mean? And so there's always that dichotomy. So I think the first and most important service that Blackout provides is community. Mm. So that black queer people in this community have a place to feel welcomed and be supported and get access to services that they may need, whether that's referrals for housing, if you need an HIV test, if you need access to healthcare, that's what we're there to do.
Gotcha. So, okay, speaking of HIV testing, so the CDC reports that black gay men are more affected by HIV than any other group in the U.S. I was not aware of that. Can you kind of explain to me why that is, or
sure.
do you know why that is, and how is Blackout trying to help remedy that issue?
Great question, and I'm reminded of the words of that great Missouri humorist, a.k.a. Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, who said that there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And I'm going to give you a stat right now that the CDC projected in 2016, that unless something changes, fully half, one out of every two black men in this country who has sex with men will contract HIV in their lifetime. And just for perspective, there are not population centers anywhere in the world, not in sub-Saharan Africa, not in the deep south of the U.S., but broadly, that doesn't even exist. And so what that means is, because we are a smaller part of the population, in Kansas City, for example, we're a smaller part of the population, we have many of the same friends, social networks, sexual partners, you're going to have prevalence in that regard. And so that is what increases the incidence rate for transmission in a community like ours. So it's not that black people are more risky in their sex, black queer men. Mm-hmm. In fact, study after study after study, and even our own study, the Vision 2020 study that Blackout did in 2018, also reflected that black same gender loving men report higher condom usage and efficacy than any other racial or ethnic demographic in the country. So it's not that we're irresponsible, we're not savage beasts that are just out there just screwing around with anything. That's not it. It's just that when you have a disease that was never treated in the way that we've done with this pandemic, with the coronavirus, which is full force to deal with
all hands on deck.
All hands on deck, exactly. And so, you know, HIV in this country just turned 40, if you will. Just last month, we celebrated, or rather commemorated, the discovery of HIV, the virus that leads to AIDS. And for so long, Black queer people were left out of that conversation. And so our needs just grew and were exacerbated as we were neglected. And it's only been in the last decade that we've really seen more Black figures really at the tables where the decisions are being made around money, resources, and how we direct what we're going to do to end the epidemic.
So I know that HIV and AIDS is not really something that's talked about that often. I think I think when Magic Johnson had it, it was like a huge thing, but that was several years ago. And
he still has it. He's living with the virus.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, there is no cure. He had access to, because he's wealthy,
right? Top medicine and
exactly. Yeah. And at the time, and so he's just very healthy. In fact, he did an interview last year because everybody keeps saying, well, Magic doesn't have HIV. Magic is healthy, and most people living with HIV are healthy if they are in care and they are adherent to their treatment plans. So HIV doesn't have to be a death sentence, but it is if you don't know your status and if you're not in care.
Gotcha.
It absolutely is. But Magic Johnson is very much a person living with HIV to this day.
Okay, because I think a lot of, maybe it's just a myth, but I think a lot of the misunderstanding about HIV and AIDS is that especially after the Magic thing is like, oh, well, that's a thing in the past. Like, nobody really has it, you know, or it's only in the gay community or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's Blackout. One of the missions also is raising awareness in general to HIV. Like, HIV is still a thing, you guys. Like, we're still combating this. Is that one of the missions as well?
Yeah, and quite honestly, you know, the group that is probably the second most affected by HIV are Black women. Particularly cisgender, heterosexual Black women. Who, and again, I'm not going to go into the whole Oprah, J.L. King down low thing from the 90s.
I was going to ask, but we'll
but there
on.
Are people who are on the down low, that's for sure, and they're not just Black men. And yes, in many respects, it is safer to be out, but it's not always true universally for a lot of people where their housing and employment is at risk. I mean, the U.S. Congress, the Senate, refused to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would prevent queer folk from being fired just for who they are. So that's been a big push to get to that point, to get that passage. And so those are realities, and so it's not always safe for everybody to just be out living their best gay life.
Right.
Having said that, Black women are oftentimes in relationships with men who are maybe either themselves unaware of their status, and they don't think that they need to be tested or have not been tested in some time, or who are not living truthfully about their activities.
Gotcha. So you mentioned Congress. And you also mentioned that in 2017, the idea for Blackout formed. Where I'm going with this is, I know that when during Trump's presidency, he had a ban.
I don't know her. To quote Mariah Carey, I don't know her. I'm sorry. I said I would behave. I'm sorry.
During former President Trump's presidency, he did have a ban on transgender receiving health care, and I think that's since been reversed.
Yeah.
What kind of health care, other than like HIV testing, do you all offer? Just general health care, or what kind of other healthcare things that you all were offering that may not have been accessible back in 2017?
Well, that's a great question, too. Again, I love this interview. You've asked all the right questions so far. What I will say is that I think that, you know, our study, the community identified 7 high priority areas. They were crime and violence. They were HIV and sexual health, healthcare access, fitness, diet, and nutrition, substance use, mental health, and what we call social determinants, although I prefer the term social influencers of health. Things that impact health, but not maybe directly.
Okay.
Housing, education, employment, those sorts of things. Because quite frankly, housing that is stable is HIV treatment. Because anybody who's got to figure out what they're going to have to do to sleep on somebody's couch, right, that they may not want to do, let's say, they're not worried about taking medicine every day. They're trying to survive.
They're trying to survive. Makes sense.
So having said that, I think that, you know, we started out and we thought that the community, especially because in 2018 when we released the study, we had just witnessed the murder of a member of the community right outside our station here. And we thought clearly crime and violence would be at the top of the list. But do you know what 18 to 34-year-old, black, same-gender-loving, queer and trans people in this city said was their number one concern? Health care access.
Mm-hmm.
And when Blackout launched in 2018, our telehealth program, I want you to know, people laughed at us. They're like, oh, that's cute. You got your little phone doctor program. Oh, how good for you. But we have a real clinic. And then there was a pandemic that happened in the year 2020.
And everybody needed it.
Everybody needed telehealth, exactly. So some of that is being able to see around the bend or around the curve. But the truth of the matter is this. We are looking at the whole person. And Blackout has launched a culture of care campaign that is really about how do we take care of black people, not only on a physical level, but on a mental and spiritual level as well.
So are your services offered to not people who are not members of the LGBTQ community, or is it just kind of centered around that community?
Absolutely. And I can tell you a little funny story. This just happened last week. So somebody reached out to us through our social media and said, hey, I'd like to get an HIV test, but I'm uncomfortable doing it at home because we could do that with them over Zoom, send them the kit, that kind of thing. Come on into our office. And by the name and given our name and who we focus on, we had no idea that this young white girl was going to come in, young lady, and want to get an HIV test, which we were happy to serve her. She was happy to be there. But what was interesting was that, you know, I asked, how did you hear about us? And she said, well, on social media, and I went and took it to my friend Peaches because they work at Bazookas downtown. And Peaches had told all the girls at Bazookas, if you need to get tested, go to Blackout. So we will serve anybody who comes our way. We focus on our community because we know that's where the greatest need is. And we make absolutely no apologies for that. We are very black centric because that's where the need is most when it comes to this issue.
Gotcha. So you mentioned something earlier about safety. And I know that part of the reason some people don't come out of the closet, as they say, is because fear of rejection, fear of getting beat up, or what have you. What kind of services, if any, does Blackout provide to help make sure that they are safe if they are in a situation where they feel like they're in danger?
Well, a lot of the work that we do is relational. And I say it often that I'd rather be relational than transactional. And so when somebody comes our way, part of our screening of individual persons, whether they come for an HIV test or they need a period pack and supplies.
Period pack?
Yeah, so we partner with a group called Barrier Babes, and they provide both condoms and safer sex supplies, but also hygienic supplies for female-bodied persons who may not have access to them otherwise. So in addition to our focus on black queer men, we're very, very focused on making sure that generally the people that we encounter, whether they are black or queer or not, or both, that we have supplies for them as well. And so what we like to do is stay up to date with other programs and services that we can partner with and send people to or through those processes. But we are looking at expanding our services well beyond what we do right now. And, you know, we operate a contract pharmacy basically that provides people access to the HIV game-changing drug PrEP, which stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's a once-a-day pill that you take to prevent contraction of HIV.
Okay.
And so that drug costs $2,000 a month.
Wow. Why is it so, why is it so expensive?
Because drug companies are greedy. And I should also say that the patent that they used to, which infringed upon really Gilead scientists to create this medication, is a government patent. And it took some time before the government enforced its patent so that we can have generics on the market and bring that price down.
Mm-hmm.
But the CDC, even with that, recommends that you get quarterly lab testing to make sure your liver and kidney function are okay, you know, check for their STIs, that sort of thing. And those all have costs. So you have a $2,000 a month medication that could be life-sustaining for you, right? Or at least prevent your life from going through a life-altering situation. Then you have on top of that quarterly labs, provider visits, so on and so forth. We provide all of that to our community absolutely free of charge. I don't say that it's free. It's free of charge or at no cost to them. We work with foundations and others to make sure that that cost is absorbed.
Okay. That was my next question, because $2,000 is not chump change.
It is not.
Especially if there are multiple people who are needing this medication. Is it to the point where, you know, if you do have insurance, that you all accepted insurance, or,
sure,
or you don't really need it because it doesn't cost for the patient, kind of thing?
Well, you know, one of the things that we learned in the study was that those who took this to some 227 people, fully half of them lacked insurance or they were underinsured. Mm-hmm. And so part of what we're doing is connecting them to insurance, making sure they have access to a provider through telehealth and telemedicine, but also looking at how can we underwrite the cost of the medications and labs and that sort of thing for them. It is not easy.
I was going to say, what's
the
process?
It's a lot of work,
yeah.
And a lot of moving parts. But here's what we learned from the study, Jasmine, that 87.1% of all of our survey respondents had heard of PrEP, but only 11.5% of them had ever been on PrEP. Mm-hmm. And of that 11.5% that were on PrEP, only 5.9% remained on it past 90 days. So what we're finding is even when you get access, you need support to be adherent. Mm-hmm. And so we have empowerment coaches that routinely check in with our members. We don't call them patients or clients. We call them members.
Oh, okay.
They check in with our members, make sure they're doing okay. Are you having any troubles? That sort of thing. We have patient care coordination teams that make sure that labs and pharmacy supplies and doctor visits happen without issue. It's a lot of moving parts, but you know what? My community is worth it, and we don't complain because we feel blessed to be in a seat to do it.
No arguments over here.
And I know you have a lot of questions about the mechanics of setting up a nonprofit and stuff, and I'm happy to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we might have to do that on episode two.
Okay.
Maybe. So, community. You said that's very important, which I agree with. What do you all have, like social events where you can just come and be free and be yourself and there's no judgment, no worry? Like, what does that look like?
Well, the context matters, right? So if we were to go on a walk outside of our studio here, we could walk to 5 or 6 or 7 different queer bars, mm-hmm. 2 on this very block, that ostensibly, again, for the broader community. But they don't always feel welcoming. I'm not saying you won't see black folk in there. I'm just saying that when you walk in, you may not always feel as a black person that you're welcome, and that's for a lot of reasons. And so what we've had to do, because we don't have a designated space, there's, if you were new to Kansas City and you said, take me to where the black gays hang out, we just wouldn't go anywhere. There's no place to go. Mm-hmm. There is no place to go. And so Blackout is working with a collective of other groups that are either queer-focused or queer-led to bring about such a space. I can't divulge. I can't break news on air right now. But hopefully you'll have me back at some point. I can talk about it. But that is key to building community, because if you don't feel visible in a community, mm-hmm. you don't feel part of the community. It's as if the community writ large, whether it has intended to or not, has written off your needs mm-hmm. and your lived experience and says that your life doesn't effectively matter because we haven't thought enough to make sure you have the resources you need to thrive.
Gotcha. Well, with that, we're going to take a break. You are listening to Next Step Forward right here on the Thursday night special on KKFI 90.1 FM. Kansas City Community Radio. We are speaking to D. Rashad Gilmore, the president and CEO of Blackout KC and the host of Unbossed and Unbothered that comes on Saturdays at 5 p.m. Stay with us. We will be right back. FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. You are listening to Next Step Forward right here on the Thursday night special. I am with my lovely guest, Mr. D. Rashad Gilmore. He's the president and CEO of Blackout KC. He's also the host of Unbossed and Unbothered that comes on Saturdays at 5 p.m. right here on KKFI. So before the break, we were talking about community and how important it is, but I kind of want to shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
I want to talk about the terminology.
Sure.
Because I think a lot of the misunderstanding comes in because people just don't know. So there's a couple terms that I found that I myself was confused. So let's start with queer.
Yeah, that is a term that if you have a certain generation would have been extremely offensive.
I was about to say that.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, queer was almost the equivalent of the N-word. It was a big no-no. You can't say it. But now I feel like more people are saying it. If you're part of the community, can you say it? Or how does that work?
Whether you are or not.
Okay.
And I will say, you know, there's no monolith in the LGBT community broadly or within the black LGBT community. So it's safe to always ask. However, queer has become sort of the catch-all term.
Okay.
Because let's face it, whether you are a member of the community or not, all those alphabets gets kind of LGBT, LMNOP. And before y'all start writing in and calling in, don't do me. But queer has become sort of the umbrella term. And it is like the N-word in this, only in this sense. I'm going to be very careful because I know some people will run away with this.
Who
are from the majority community. It was us taking back something that had been used to negatively define, stereotype, or stigmatize.
Okay. So it's taken back in the same sense as the N-word, but don't use it derogatory. Otherwise, you
don't. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be problems.
You know,
people like the B word, and I refer to my friends as that quite often.
Right.
But depending on setting and tone and context,
gotcha.
We might be having a different conversation after you say those words.
Okay. So it's okay to say queer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah, that's a safe word.
All right. Good to know. So we have another acronym, MSM.
Yes. And that the term originated from the CDC, effectively, but it means men who have sex with men.
Okay.
And it was their attempt at speaking to men who did not identify as gay, because there are men who have sex with men who they don't see this. They may not even have an emotional attraction to men. They may be physically doing a thing, or they may be gay for pay, or they may be in a situation, i.e. incarceration, where they are having the sex that they can't have, if you will. But the reason why we are increasingly moving away from that term is because, for me, it defines us by a behavior, not who we are as people. And so I like to use the term same gender loving. If we're talking about gay men or men who have sex with men, same gender loving, because it at least humanizes us in a way that shows that it's not just about our sexual behavior or performance, but about our love for one another.
Gotcha. Okay. So is MSM still okay to use?
Yeah, and you'll mostly hear it in healthcare settings or scientific readings, that sort of thing. But most people in the community are going to use some sort of shorthand that's going to either be gay or queer in a lot of cases. And often that's unfortunate, too, because it leaves out our trans siblings who may or may not be gay.
Speaking of trans, so trans woman, trans man, what does that mean? So if you're a trans woman, does that mean that you were born a man and now you are a woman, or how does that work?
Well, I will sort of demystify this as best I can, and certainly any of my friends in the community who may be listening or our trans siblings, feel free to opine directly or later after we're off the air. But a couple of things to understand, and then a couple other acronyms. There are FTM, female to male.
Okay.
MTF, male to female. So those are a couple of careful signifiers there, right? And I think what's important to understand is that trans people are not confused in the head. And I think part of the problem is that we feel like gender identity, we feel like it begins with the genitalia, but it doesn't. It begins in the mind.
Oh, okay.
And so when your gender, physical, your genitalia rather, does not identify or align with how you identify mentally, that's why people want to have and need to have and have a right to have affirmational either acceptance, recognition, or surgery if necessary, or if they like that, prefer that. Not everybody does or can afford to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's important to know. Trans people are not crazy. They're not monsters. There's nobody trying to sneak into the bathroom and touch little children.
Mm.
That's for pedophiles, which does not include our community.
Gotcha. So within the umbrella, and you said it was female to male.
And that would be somebody who was born female-bodied, if you will, and they are transitioning to male.
So would that fit under the umbrella of a trans woman or a trans male?
So what I say to people is the gender that's at the end of that, FTM, man.
Okay.
MTF, woman, female.
Got it.
So, and there are several, thinking of three or four people who just flew through my mind who are trans, but who don't identify as queer in the sense of they don't have a same-sex attraction.
Okay.
It's confusing other people because they refuse to see them as who they are, not just what they see in front of them.
So would an example of that be like Laverne Cox then, because she dates men, but she's also trans. Is that right?
Trans woman, heterosexual trans woman. That's probably the best way to say that. Yeah.
Okay, because I know as a heterosexual, and I know there's another term, is it cisgender or?
And cisgender just means that your body and your mind, how you see yourself gender-wise, it all lines up. You see yourself as a woman and your body physically reflects that
Okay.
reality for you.
Gotcha. So what does like pansexual mean then?
And so I think a few things have to be sort of explained. One is there is sexuality, there's gender identity, then there's queerness. All those things kind of come into play.
Okay.
And so a pansexual person, maybe somebody who does not either identify as a singular gender or could be multiple, and they may be attracted to people who, based on gender or not, that's who they're attracted to. So they could be male, they could be female, they could be non-binary in the sense that they don't choose to identify because they don't see themselves as male, female.
Okay. Because I remember when Janelle Monae, who's a Kansas Cityan, came out as pansexual, there was a big hoopla about it because it was a term that wasn't known yet. Yeah. And I think it's still a term that is starting to become more knowledgeable about it, but it's still like, okay, what are you talking about?
But pansexual attraction really is about, I don't really care about the physical form of the person, whether they be male bodied or female bodied or this genitalia or that. I'm not concerned about that as a pansexual person. What a pansexual person is concerned about is who is the person underneath all of that, inside of that.
Okay.
Male, female, non, who is the individual?
So they wouldn't be in the same category as like a bisexual who says, I like both men and women. A pansexual says, I just like people.
Effectively, I think that's good shorthand. Now, I want to say to your listeners that I'm sure are keyed in very closely here. We're not going to be able to do a deep dive and a full exegesis on all of this.
We don't have time for
that. That's a safe understanding, I feel.
Okay, so non-conforming gender.
Gender non-conforming.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gender non-conforming. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that they don't identify as a male or a female? Or
you may hear the term fluid. These often get lumped together. So non-binary, gender non-conforming, fluid.
Okay. Now, is that different than gender binary then?
So the gender binary is just what we've all been raised with, right? Which is you're either male or female. If you're a boy, you get these toys. If you're a girl, you get these toys.
Okay.
And if you're a girl, you like these colors. And if you're a boy, you're supposed to like those colors. People who are non-binary say, I don't accept that paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't accept that I have to be either of those things.
Don't put me in a box.
Or I could be both. Effectively, yes.
Okay, got it. I hope you guys learn something with that, because these are terms that we hear often, but we may not really understand what they mean or how to approach people.
And Google is your friend. I tell you all the time, Google University will get you through a lot of stuff.
So I know the big thing now is pronouns. How would you approach someone if you're first meeting them? Do you just effectively say my pronouns, or do you ask someone, like, is there a proper protocol to how that works?
Well, you have to know the secret handshake. I'm just kidding. it's almost always safest to ask.
Okay.
But how you ask matters too. What are you?
Oh, yeah.
A human? What are you, savage? I mean, you know, it's just, you know, I want to respect you as who you are.
Mm-hmm.
What pronouns do you prefer? Mine are, you know, my personal pronouns, D. Rashawn Gilmore, are he, him, his, HBIC. and that appears on my Zoom. And all the people go, so those are my pronouns.
Okay.
And then there's they, them, which confuse, I don't know, they as a singular has been in the English language for centuries. This is not new.
That was my next question, because I know, in my research for the show, there has been a lot of talk about people who are non-binary. I guess they don't identify as a male or female. They would prefer to be called them or they. But I know that sometimes before, you know, we have been more conscious of how we approach people of the LGBTQ community. We always just say them or they. So now, is it one of the things where we have to be extra cautious so that we don't offend people, or we just...
Well, I think it's inevitable. Anytime you are attempting to be an ally to a marginalized group, there is always the risk of offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to know that going in. be prepared for that, but know how to deal with it, how to address it. And so if you misgender somebody unintentionally, just simply say, my apologies, I'm working on it, I will catch myself, and just keep moving. Don't make a huge deal about it. My apologies. If they stop and correct you. In fact, even among my own team, we frequently have to do that. We have members of our team and our board that are gender nonconforming or non-binary, and it's so easy to say, because you can look at the person, their female body, oh, she.
Yeah.
And it's not uncommon at all for somebody to, they, or for somebody to kind of catch themselves. So we have a rule around the office. If I get me, you can't get me too. So if I catch the error and I correct it, I don't need you to opine and jump on my back about it. We acknowledge it. We apologize. We move on.
Gotcha. So is education, we just had a whole vocabulary lesson. Is education one of the things that Blackout is really trying to do so that people can understand how to approach?
No. You know, my it's a personal philosophy of mine. It's a fair question, but it's a personal philosophy of mine that I am more focused and would rather spend more of my time, energy, and efforts on empowering the people that I serve rather than trying to educate those who are outside of that community.
Gotcha.
There are others, and there are certainly times like now, or I do webinars where that may come about.
Mm-hmm.
My primary focus is how do I build up the people who are on the receiving end of stigma and shame, who have a lack of access, who don't get to navigate the systems the way other people do. How can I serve them and build them up? I'm less concerned about educating people who oftentimes choose to be ignorant or they're too lazy and lethargic. Exactly.
Gotcha.
It doesn't impact me, but you don't know how it impacts you, because there are people in your life, believe me, that would never, ever come to you with their true selves or identity because you have that attitude and you cut yourself off from a very important part of them when you could be there to support them as a result.
Gotcha. I want to switch gears.
Okay.
So the Black Queer, now that I know I can say that without...
Ooh, I'm telling. I'm about to call the gay NAACP, the Rainbow Squad.
So... lately, especially within, I would say, the last decade or so, we have seen a lot of Black queer influence, particularly Black queer men influence.
Come on, Lil Nas X, Billy Porter.
Right. But a lot of it has an effect on Black culture, but also culture as a whole. So you have sayings like, yes, or yes, queen, or spilling the tea, or clutching my pearls, stuff like
shade,
that.
Shade, reading.
Shade, read. All of these things that are very prevalent within the Black culture, but kind of spilling over into just general pop culture. So why do you think it is, one, that Black queer men has such an influence over popular culture, but they don't get the credit for it, and they don't get support when they need it?
That is a layered question, but a really terrific one. The truth of the matter is we act like gay people, queer people just arrived here like it was the latest trend from 20 years ago. So, you know, and I was talking to a friend of mine who is a former pastor and runs a nonprofit called Universal Love Alliance in Uganda, where they actually have passed legislation that would outlaw being gay or queer and could lead to the death penalty. So if you knew I was gay and you didn't report me within 24 hours, new or suspected, mind you, you could literally be jailed for life. And I'm not talking about 50 years ago. I mean today.
Wow.
And it was white evangelicals from right here, not only in the U.S., but in Kansas City.
Mm.
So I would encourage your listeners to check out the movie God Loves Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about that and the roots that it has here in Kansas City. Now, having said that, I do think that one of the biggest challenges that we face is that... I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is that we are so busy othering everybody that we don't take time to pause and be inclusive, because being inclusive is not hard, but it does require intentionality. And so when I think about a Lil Nas X or all the little gay Black boys who are styling all these celebrities, including athletes and others who would never let them be out front, but would certainly profit from or benefit from their influence, you got to ask yourself the question, what is it about me that's so fearful of them or an association with them that I have to sequester their light as if it would put my own out? And the truth of the matter is, one reason why we see such misogyny, and it happens toward not just women, but Black gay men, is because we really have an issue with women. Femininity is problematized. And so anything that approximates that is often put down.
I see what you're saying. So because women in general are hated against anything that reflects a woman, whether it be a woman being a woman or a male having, I'm putting
it's perceived as weaker, bad, whatever. Huh. Yes. And so, you know, it's interesting that so many people, before Lil Nas X came out, right? Mm-hmm. Old Town Road. I mean, everybody, my nephews, we get in the car. Oh, Uncle, can you turn
that
on?
That was played at all the elementary school dances.
Everywhere. And then he came out, and then you started to hear, particularly black men, black cisgender men, saying straight men, oh man, I'm not going to sing that no more. But it was fine. But what happened? Did your knowledge that he is gay somehow make you gay? Are you questioning yourself? Are you how solid is your masculinity that you have to keep such big constraints on it? The way you walk, talking to black men, the way you walk, the colors you wear, the people you're around, is your masculinity so fragile that you can't afford to have anything that doesn't represent it around you, lest it reflect on you and somehow diminish you further? Like, I don't get it.
It's interesting that you said, like, what you wear, because it made me think of Cameron back in, like, the early 2000s. He wore a bunch of pink, and all of a sudden, you see all these dudes wearing these big, pink, tall tees. And it's like, a couple of years ago, if you got found wearing pink, you know,
it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. Problem. Now all of a sudden, Cameron's wearing pink, and it's like, oh man, let me go get that pink tall tee and with my flip phone. Like, you know, it's so. I'm interested to know, like, do you think it depends on who says it's okay to be cool with queer people in order to, you know? So you talked about dress, right? So Cameron wore pink. All right, well now it's cool to wear pink. But if you know, somebody else wore pink that might be of the LGBT, that might be queer. Mm-hmm. It is a lot shorter to say queer.
It's easy shorthand for all of us.
Yeah. That might be queer, then it's like, oh, I'm not finna wear no pink because I'm not gonna be looked at as gay. You know what I'm saying? Like, why do you think that is? Does it just depend on the person?
You know, it on a micro level, yes, it does depend on the person and who they are and how secure they are and who they are. But it also is on a macro level, on a societal level. And I don't know what white men's issue is, but for black men, some people will find this troubling, and I really have to not be dismissive, but be honest and say I don't care that they will have trouble with what I'm about to say. It has a lot of its roots in slavery and the colonial relationship, if you can even call it that, that African descendants of Africa have with this country. When you are pulled away from your homeland, mm-hmm. shipped thousands of miles away, right? You're stripped of your name, your language, your culture, all of that. And then your family's taken away from you. The one thing that, you know, as a man, you feel you're supposed to protect and take. When you get to a place where your masculinity is constantly called into question, your humanity is constantly called into question, then it does make you assert it in other ways.
Hmm.
And so there is this need to prove I'm masculine. And it happened. You can look in a lot of Latin cultures, you'll see that too. The problem is we sort of overcorrect for it.
To prove.
And so, you know, I always have such healthy respect for my many heterosexual black male friends who could care less that I'm gay. They see me for who I am. They respect. They don't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not trying to ignore it like they don't know. They just respect me for it. But that's a choice they made. I'm not busy trying to prove myself to them. They're secure in who they are. Many others are not, unfortunately.
So we talked about influence a little bit ago, but and you touched on a little bit, but can you expound on like why you think there is such a large influence on just how queer, particularly queer black men, have on just the community at large?
Yeah, that's the role that God gave us, that the universe gave us. Now, again, that may be controversial to some, but I encourage your listeners to check out this an African spiritual teacher named Sobhanfu.
Mm-hmm.
And it's spelled just like it sounds, S-O-B-O-N-F-U. Sobhanfu talks about how in many African cultures and tribal origins, queer men were considered the gatekeepers. So it's not a surprise to me that we're gatekeepers of culture and arts and many aspects of socialized society. And so it doesn't surprise me at all. It's the gift that we've been given. Unfortunately, as is the case often in life, sometimes people aren't ready to accept your gift, but it doesn't mean you are any less of a gift to those who will receive it.
Just because they can't accept your light doesn't mean you got to stop shining.
No, they'll borrow it from time to time because it helps them, you know, when they got to, you know, get dressed for the draft or, you know, music video or whatever, or you need to get your face beat. That's not a violent term, people. That means getting your makeup put on.
That was one of the terms that I was going to write down. But to me, you know, being in the Black culture is like, get my face beat. Yeah, exactly. But I just forget that people have no idea what that means.
Well, there's a special relationship between, particularly in the Black community, between queer men, gay men, and Black women. Mm-hmm. It is often a very symbiotic and healthy relationship, though not always.
Yeah.
I will say that there are a lot of people, because of their religious upbringing, who have a whole lot of issues to work through.
Yeah.
And can I just say this? Stop saying to your gay friends, I love everybody, I don't care what sin. You saying that to me is the equivalent of saying, I may be white and you may be Black, but I love you regardless of your sin. But my Blackness is not a sin. It's who I am.
Okay.
My queerness, my gayness is not a sin. It is who I am. So while you think you're saying something helpful, you're actually part of the problem.
Gotcha. Okay, last question.
What? Are we done? I have more stuff to say.
Last question. So we're coming off of Pride Month, and all of these big corps had their rainbow, changed their logos to rainbow this and rainbow that. Do you find that there's actually some allyship with these big corps for the queer community? Or is it just, we're going to get this money come June, and then come July, we're taking that down, and it's back to normal?
I think in the same way that we as Black people know who our real allies are, if they're coming from corporations or from individual politicians or celebrities or whatnot, the same is true in the LGBT community. We know who our real friends and supporters are, and we know that in a capitalist society, it's all about the only color that matters, which is green. So there are some who really do show and prove. There are others who are just faking the funk because it's the thing to do, and because they will benefit from it financially.
I said that was the last question, but I have another one. But I will.
Okay, rapid fire round. I'll be quick.
No, I can't, because it's gonna happen. I'm gonna have another question, and then another question, and then another question. Dear Rashad, this has been great.
Thank you so much for having me, Jasmine. And can I just say that I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
As a member of the KKF family and just watching all that you do. And this today was just exciting, and I'm grateful. Thank you.
I'm like, don't give me too many flowers. I'm going to cry.
No, you deserve it. And I'll be a faithful listener. And I hope that your audience that's listening today will be as well.
I appreciate that. You have been listening to Next Step 4 right here on the Thursday night special. My guest tonight, wonderful, informative, awesome, HBIC, as he says, has been D. Rashad Gilmore. He is the president and the CEO of Blackout KC. He is also the host of Unbossed and Unbothered, which comes on Saturdays at 5 p.m. right here on KKFI. Please stay tuned for the local showcase with various hosts.